Okay, thank you. I'm not to, well, not disclaimers, but to things, I'm not an expert in doping. Feels rather new to me, but I know a couple of things about surveillance. And that's why I'm here today and what I thought. That there are some interesting overlappings to look at doping from surveillance studies, if you so want, perspective. From the last session, it has become clear that the fight against doping is although complicated, there's a bottom line that it is good that people do that. And there's no question that in doing so, there have to be controls. There has to be checks, whatever they be. The more complicated stuff then starts when, you know, about the controls, about the details, about the natural sciences stuff, things I don't really understand, but have to be there. Another thing that is pretty clear is whenever a camera goes up somewhere in a town center, nobody wants that really, right? There's a big, at least there's an outrage of some people, anti-surveillance groups, civil rights groups, data protection groups go up and say, this camera shall not be there. And you can substitute camera for loyalty cards, you can substitute cameras for passports, biometrics, etc. So there's an outrage. There's almost never an outrage when it comes to doping controls. Very, very little. And the reporting in the wider public and the media is about, it's not so much about outrage against controls again within the fight of doping. And as we've just heard from Hayo Seppelt, he wants to explore to see what is more important, privacy rights of individuals or the integrity of sports. And that would be an interesting debate indeed to see, because I think there is an uneven comparison here. I'll come to that later. So why is there no outrage against doping controls, and why are doping controls a very, very intense form of surveillance? I'm going to tell you about something about the forms of surveillance within doping controls. I'll speak a little bit about the implications, and I'll talk a little bit about research perspectives, things that maybe may have been left out, and I'm interested in. Okay, the forms of doping controls are the following. They can be invasive, blood testing, urine testing, everything that transgresses the boundaries of your body, that transgresses the boundaries of your personal space, is I deem invasive. They can be locational. The ADAMS system is as an example of locational surveillance. You have to be, you know, you have to say where you are. Although you're not tagged, it is almost as if you are tagged because of the consequences if you don't do it. A tag would be a locational device. You know, everybody could just be tagged, like prisoners can be tagged with a tag to follow where he or she is. There is self-surveillance. Athletes engage in various forms of self-surveillance. They watch out for the body, their nutrition, the drugs they take, their training. It regulates their life. So they, in a very Foucauldian sense, they are the most disciplined bodies that we probably have. Okay, it's a constant process of self-surveillance that they engage in. And surveillance could be permanent. A tag, a non-removable tag, could be permanent. It could be injected into your body, RFID or GPS things, or even more nano whatever the medical and biochemistry comes up with, things in your body that control substances within your body. Yeah? Speaking about with science fiction, but maybe not so much science fiction. The cyborg, if you so want. Okay, what are the implications of this? The implications, for one, is individual rights seem to be suspended in a way. If you engage in sport and you're willing to, or you consent to it, as Jonas Hoffman said, you know, informed consent, you disband some of your civil and individual rights. And apparently, the wider public thinks that's okay because you're a sport, you're an athlete, and you have to. I think this is a very doubtful notion. And one can question if this suspension of your personal rights is a necessity, is an absolute necessity for doing and engaging in sports, and particular in high class, high level athletic engagement. What about the self-determination of the athlete, subjectivity of the athlete, agency of the athlete? How much is he, you know, is he himself? He watches himself or herself, but how much has the athlete a say in what actually, and what the outcome of the self-surveillance is? Just to be more beautiful or just to fulfill some rules that are not made by the athlete themselves? What about the bodily integrity? Is there a necessity to give this up? And the question comes back to Hayo Zeppelt, you know, privacy or sports integrity. What about bodily integrity? Why can it be transgressed only if sports, you know, and what is integrity of sports then anyway? A second, and that comes back to Jonas Hoffman, when he said, you know, we don't have to watch the individual, but we also have to watch the entourage, check on everybody, means every effort to evade control generates new methods to control, new ideas and new strategies to control and surveil the athlete, the entourage, the system, the family, everybody who's possibly in contact. Like, you know, you're looking for a terrorist and you check on everybody he shakes hands with. You know, we're speaking of athletes here. So maybe false comparison, maybe not. Okay. There's a feedback loop, a cycle of surveillance that feeds itself. The more you control, the more people try to evade, the more you invent other techniques to again surveil. You know, where does it stop? Is that worth doing it? And where do we want it to end? Again, integrity of sport. Consequence of locational privacy. The Adam system and maybe, you know, think about tags. This is data that is fed into larger systems. On the internet, there's a sharing of data between databases. Once that system, biometric and biological data of athletes, of individual persons, is in that system, it got shared all around the world between agencies, between WADA and NADA, and national agencies, between the sports federations. Who tells me that it's not shared between Interpol, the FBI, national police agencies, social security in various countries, the health system, whatnot? There is a function, what is called a function creep. Well, in this case, there's a purpose creep of that data. Once it's out in the databases and it's going along the cycles, the internet, the networks, it is out there. No matter how well it is protected, it is out there and you can misuse it. If it's not being hacked, it can be misused. Okay? Someone just gives a CD to some, you know. We've seen that with tax evasion. Why not with doping? Three minutes, okay. There's permanent, well, I speak a little about permanent doping, but I think the next session on tech doping will elaborate on that much more. So bodily enhancements or prosthetics or whatever you can do. So there's permanent doping, and that raises far more moral questions about what it is to be human, and what kind of controls are possible within you that, you know, you don't have to have anybody that follows you. You don't have to enter your data in the system. It is always there, right? It's not self-surveillance. It's something in your body that watches you, you know. What are the consequences of this? Self-determination, agency of the athlete, and so forth. What I'm interested in researching is, and what I think is a lack of, is how is doping viewed by the athlete, right? How are the practices viewed? Because surveillance is not a set of techniques or a set of technological gadgets, but it's also, it establishes itself in the practices, and the practice of watching, gathering data, how an athlete is engaging with certain systems. And this engagement lies also a form of resistance. You can, you know, maybe there are ways to engage with atoms to resist some of the occasional breaches of privacy that happen there. So how people actually assess the practices that they engage in as an athlete, as a watched athlete, as a controlled athlete, as an athlete that wants to enhance their abilities through training or other, I'm interested in the notions that the athletes themselves speak about doping or the practices within which doping is embedded. I think that gives a clearer view about how we can make statements, even moral statements, on what doping is and what controls are possible, how far it may go, how far it may not go. That means to also to research into the whole assemblage of things and actions that surround doping practices. I want to finish with an argument by Olivier Nigli made earlier. He said, you know, they pay respect to data protection, and then he mentioned, well, data protection, when I see what the people do on Facebook and Twitter, well, maybe it's not, well, he didn't say not so important, but he made it sound like maybe that's not so important because the people are not really watching out for their privacy on Facebook and Twitter. And I find this very audacious or even dangerous to think about, just because someone privately, voluntarily gives up data and says, hello, this is my dog, my whatever, you know, my room, my girlfriend, on Facebook, come to my party, to think that I have the right then to ask for other stuff and to post other stuff on him or her, just because someone does it voluntarily. Because I have a tattoo does not mean someone can come and give me yet another one or brand mark me on my arm. You know, the first one was voluntarily, the second probably is not. So I think there's a dangerous thing to say, you know, and we have to be very wary. And again, to research, to finish it up, this is what I'm interested in the whole practice of doping and athlete's life that makes it up. So to find where the limits are, where the personal limits are, and where we maybe have to draw a limit even to safeguard the athletes for by whatever himself. And that's it. Thank you.